listening to American Studies Critical Perspectives, a six-part lecture series by Stockton College Professor Kristen Jacobson. The lecture series took place at Medford University, located on the Medford Lees campus in Medford, New Jersey. Lecture 1, Introduction to the Study of American Culture.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to welcome you to the fall program of Medford University. Anyone who hasn't been to this part of Medford Lees recently has found a new look and some exciting changes owing to the completion of the arts and social wing. Ribbon cutting for the wing will be on Saturday, September 29th, followed by our third annual community day. Everyone is invited to come and enjoy a day of fun, activities, and a barbecue, all free of charge. Meanwhile, the auditorium remains unchanged. That means that anyone wishing to speak must wait for an usher to bring a microphone. Otherwise, the people wearing headsets will be unable to hear what is being said, and hopefully there will be a lively discussion in the last part of class that many will want to hear and to participate in. For another week or two, the new restrooms just outside the auditorium entrance will not be available, so count on using the non-denominational ones on either side of the water fountain in the hallway through which you pass to get here. Finally, we are going to audio tape the lectures. In case you miss one, you may borrow the tape by writing me a note or phoning in a request. And finally, also, you've all had a parking problem today if you came by car close to the time of the lecture. So I would suggest anybody who can do so to carpool, and so we can make the best use of the parking space that we have. Rarely has the advance notice of a course raised the enthusiasm and expectation this one has, and rightly so. Dr. Kristen Jacobson, Assistant Professor of American Literature and Women's Studies at the Richard Stockton College of New Jersey, not only is proficient in her subject, but also in integrating technology with her teaching. She has designed a website to enrich her class material for her course, American Studies Cultural Perspectives, and she will explain how to use it. You also have a yellow handout reviewing her guidelines. Dr. Jacobson has been teaching at Stockton since 2005. Before that, she taught at Penn State and the University of Colorado in Denver and Boulder. She has published articles in scholarly journals and presented papers on aspects of contemporary literature at academic association conferences. She has twice received a Richard Stockton College Research and Professional Development Fellowship, a college-wide competitive award, and twice a Richard Stockton College Divisional Research and Development Grants for research and travel to conferences. She received a certificate in teaching with technology at Penn State in 2004, and this summer earned a stipend for a two-week intensive in podcasting and pedagogy. Dr. Jacobson earned her BA in English summa cum laude at Carthage College in Kenosha, Wisconsin, her master's in English at the University of Colorado, Boulder, and her PhD in English at Penn State University. Before turning over the mic to her, I would like to acknowledge the role of two residents in bringing her here. Miriam Brush mentioned to me that Joy Mall was a retired professor of Stockton. Joy, in turn, contacted her friend, Dr. Lucinda Jassel, who coordinates the Stockton Speaker Bureau. Dr. Jassel, in turn, contacted Kristen. And now, without further delay, please welcome Dr. Kristen Jacobson.
Thank you. to begin by thanking Kay and the rest of the Medford Lees University committee for bringing me here, for the technical support that I have today, and especially to you all, because like any good teacher, I know that without my students, I can't do my job. I really appreciate your commitment to learning and your willingness to join with me for a series of 6 lectures on American culture. Before we get started, too, I also want to explain a little bit about the website. And I have here, or if you want to look at your yellow handout, so that if you have internet access, you can go back after class. And in fact, I am taking a digital recording up here, putting some of that podcasting to work. And I'm going to have it available for you. Oh, sure. Can you hear me better now? Great. Let me know, too, if I start speaking too fast, a hand up. I need to speak closer to the mic. I ask all my students to help me out there. That feedback from you is very helpful. Thanks. So on this yellow sheet, you'll have the address that you need to go to in your web browser, and you'll come to this page. And I assure you that when it's projected up here, it's a little difficult to see, but when you're looking at your computer screen, it's a lot clearer, okay? And I just want to point out a couple of features. The pages across the right side there of the screen where I'm putting the browser, each of these are little pages. You can read a little bit more about me, who I am, where I went to school, a little bit about the Medford University. Back here in terms of what this class is about, what classes are offered. Down a little bit further, there are pages that will take you outside of our internal sort of class site. Those are the associates. They each have little kind of names like that. So if you clicked on Dr. J's website, that's what my students often call me, is Dr. J. That'll take you outside, and you can see some of my information. So if you want to look at some of the classes that I teach at Stockton and have taught elsewhere, you can go there. But the thing to keep in mind is that when you do that, you're going to have to click your back button to get back to where we were. So you can explore the different links. Another thing that you can explore or consider using is the class discussion board. We'll have time for discussion at the end, but there may be something that you think about in the week intervening, or a question that you would like to ask. And you can include that here on the discussion board. All you have to do, you can see sometimes there'll be something posted there that you can read. Click on the comments. And then you can leave a reply. If you scroll down, you'll see that it's asking for some information here. That's just to assure. Believe it or not, there are robots that can come into sites and then they leave advertisements and sometimes things even less desirable than advertisements on your website. And so this is a sort of safeguard, too, to make sure that these computer robots aren't coming in and putting things up on our website that we wouldn't want up there. So you can leave a reply, a comment, message, question. And you can also, eventually, if you click on lecture recordings, go there, and I'll have the digital recording of this lecture posted. So if you do have internet access and you are not on dial-up, it's really slow if you're dialing in, but if you have a high-speed internet connection, it's a great feature. Okay? There are lots of other little snazzy buttons on the website, but basically the pages that have the information and that discussion board are the most important for you to know in the features that if you go to the website that you can utilize, okay? If you have any questions about the website, please let me know. I'll usually be here a little while before class. You can always ask me before class or ask me afterward, okay? So let's get started with our first day. The first lecture in this American Studies Critical Perspectives series is entitled Introduction to the Study of American Culture. And I have some learning objectives for us today. Basically, what I'd like to do today is to set up information that's going to help us understand what the following five lectures are all about. That is, what is American Studies? How do we study American culture? How is it done? And today we're going to focus on four key terms: high and low culture, folk and popular cultures. And I imagine, like any good student, a few of you are out there wondering, well, what's all this worth? Why should I spend time thinking about American culture? You might be convinced that reading some American culture, like maybe a good Hawthorne novel, is worth spending your time. But you'll notice that Hawthorne isn't on our agenda for the next five Tuesdays, right? We have things like Extreme Makeover Home Edition mentioned. Some jazz music, too, right? Yeah. But there's a variety of high and low cultures that we'll be engaged with. So we definitely want to have a discussion, and I'm going to present a few arguments about why not only I think it's worth spending our brain power for the next few Tuesdays on a variety of aspects of American culture, but why other scholars in the field of American studies think that as well. So those are our goals for today. First of all, what is American Studies? And I'm drawing here from John F. Stevens' Encyclopedia of American Studies Online. And he basically says in this definition that it encompasses a vast range of disciplines that are all trying to do one thing, or they all share a common goal, and that is try to describe the cultures of the United States, which is not an easy task, nor a means that everyone agrees on. So in recent years, too, it's not just focused on what we might call the geographic United States, but it's incorporated comparative studies of Canada and Latin America. And indeed, as American culture and American influence becomes increasingly global, it's looking at those aspects as well. Where, after all, Stevens writes, do the borders of America stop when its influence was, throughout the 20th century, so pervasive in world cultures? So there's some content associated to the study of American culture, right? We define it in terms of geography. You study a geographic region and its global influence. There's a lot of question about identity. In other words, you consider what makes America exceptional, unique, and how Americans define themselves as unique individuals, as a unique nation. And we're also interested in the myths or the ideology, the underlying elements, our stories that we tell, our American dreams. And to do this, what makes American studies or the study of American culture different than, let's say, if I was just giving lectures on my other sort of field of specialty, American literature, is that we do so from an interdisciplinary approach. We don't privilege one specific discipline or genre or a kind of text. So I put here a large list of the various kinds of disciplines associated with American studies. And you can see it ranges from traditional arts and humanities disciplines to the sciences, sociology, philosophy, ethnic studies, government studies, education, gender studies, library science, you name it, American studies, like American culture, probably has it in there. So we not only draw from a range of disciplines, but a range of texts. And now we're getting into those four key terms that I want to talk about today. Popular and folk cultures, which are usually associated with a term called low culture, and then high culture. And one of the things that you'll probably notice over the next few minutes, is that these categories, while distinct, often rely on each other in their definitions. So the way I define high culture probably really depends on how I'm defining low culture. What's considered folk culture depends on how I'm defining what's not folk culture. So what is high culture? Think about that for a minute. I'm going to suggest that one of the ways that we know when something's high culture is that it's not mass-produced or meant necessarily for mass consumption. It's above commercial concerns, right? It's not usually set out there to make money, or we don't think about it in that way. It has that elite sense to it. There's also a sense that certain people get to decide what high culture is, like professors at universities, right? And other people don't. Part of it is that they have to learn what high culture is. And that there's not a lot of contradictions between what that element, what that text, what that piece of art represents, and the values that that culture is trying to represent through that, maybe that piece of art or that piece of literature. It tends not to be contradictory between what the user wants it to represent and what the text itself is trying to represent. So what does that mean exactly? Well, I think that the museum, right, is a great example of how high culture gets determined. I don't get to decide usually what is put in an exhibit. A curator does that, right? Someone who's gone to school for a long time. Someone who knows what art is and what art isn't. And so what gets into a museum often is what is called high culture, or what literary critics include in the canon. That's what gets to be called high culture. So how is folk culture different? What is folk culture? We can also think of its use. That folk culture, like high culture, is not mass-produced or necessarily meant for mass consumption. But maybe one thing that really makes it unique is that one of the characteristics, fundamental characteristics of folk culture, is that it resists change. It's really about tradition. And that the selection is an elite, but it's a very different kind of elite. That is, that the regional or local group, the insiders, are in charge of maintaining that tradition. Whereas outsiders are maybe often discouraged from participation or use. Not always. Sometimes, right, we can go to a particular festival that a town may be having and celebrate their folk cultures. But many times it's a much more private kind of celebration or food or everyday practice. And again, like high culture, there's usually not a lot of contradictions between what the practice is or what that text is that's representing folk culture and the people who are making it and reproducing it. It really, folk culture represents the values of the people who use it. An example here, I have a cover from folk music. Afro-American, right, it represents a particular culture. Folk music, not something you're going to hear on most radio stations. Not meant for necessarily for mass consumption. These aren't the rock stars of the music world. And determined by the culture itself and passed on traditionally, not through recordings like this, but from one person teaching another person that particular song. Now let's look at probably one of the most controversial terms, popular culture. And to begin to look at this concept, I want to start to understand what popular culture is by breaking it down into two parts. First of all, what's popular? The first way to think about what is popular is to think of it in terms of statistics. John Fiske, who's an author who I drew from in preparing this lecture, talks about statistical popularity as a quantitative index, something that can be measured. Seems simple enough, right? But when you think about American culture, well, where do we draw the line? How many people have to think something's popular, or how many people have to engage with a particular piece of popular culture for it to be called popular culture? For example, how many of you listen to Britney Spears? For the record of the recording, no one raised their hands except me. Maybe I only listened to her just so I could relate to some of my students. But I don't think anyone here would argue, right, that Britney Spears, therefore, is not popular. So how we just, that quantitative index is sort of, well, popular for who? And that might also, and I hope that when we get to the discussion portion, that we'll talk a little bit about your own engagement with popular culture. Because many times, although it's not here in the lecture proper, popular culture has a association with youth culture. That the youth really are the ones who are making the selection. And whether or not you agree with that, if that's true to your own experience. So another way that John Fiske talks about how we decide what's popular, how we understand what's popular, is to say that it serves the interests of the people. They select it because it does something for them, even if it's just pure entertainment. Now, for some, this is a really fearful notion, especially if you have a large investment in what people should be doing or reading, what movies they see, what literature they read. If that's really something that the experts should take care of. And if the masses are making these kinds of decisions, yeah, sometimes, right? Oh, I'm not so sure that's such a good idea. It can be a very fearful notion. What if that group gets out of control? What if people stop reading? Right? Maybe we need to have people to tell us to read particular books. What if people just stopped reading Shakespeare? Would that be a tragedy? Yes. Right? I have a certain investment in that too. I don't want people to stop reading Shakespeare. So it's still required in the curriculum, much of the curriculum at Stockton College in the literature program. But we can see on the other extreme, well, if it's not popular, if the audience doesn't see the use, then how do we value that culture? Can we value anything, then, that's not selected by an elite? There's a whole school of thought, in fact, that looks at the sort of fear and potential of the masses selecting a bulk part of American culture. And the Frankfurt School in particular, and they're neat because they have all these great, great names, Adorno, Habermas, they're good names. I like to have my students drop them in conversation. So when they call mom and dad, right, they feel like our tuition dollars are being put to good use, right? Like, oh, we're reading Theodore Adorno. Oh, he sounds like a smart guy, right? And they were worried that the masses really weren't the right people to make some of these decisions. And so that popular culture, as a result, wasn't as valued, and maybe even had a bit of a dangerous edge. Culture. Let's look at the second half of this term. One way to think of it is it's a way of life. It's our lived cultures, our cultural practices, celebrations, youth culture, the culture of older people, the culture of, I don't know, 30-something people like me. And it includes not only that way of life, but those signifying practices. In other words, it's not only what you do, but it's also the products of what you do. From everything from soap operas to popular music to literature. So culture refers to a social circulation of meanings, values, pleasures. I would add in here texts. It's the process involved in forming social identities and social relationships. And we can think of culture in what geographers might call at different scales. You might have your smaller family scale of culture, your individual practices, stories that you tell each other. You may have a community culture here at Medford Lees, which is distinctive and requires its own sort of set of knowledge. Think back to maybe when you first moved here and things that you needed to learn in order to become a successful community member or a member of this culture. And then we have our own national or even state cultures. Think about New Jersey's identity. We get a bad rap sometimes, don't we? Yeah. So that state identity, that state culture, as well as a national identity. Embedded in all of this is this key term called ideology. And I would say that when you add the popular plus the culture, you're going to get a really interesting picture of the ideology of America. That it's a way to kind of take a pulse, not the pulse, but a significant pulse of the nation and what it values. So ideology, the sort of dictionary definition, is a systematic body of ideas articulated by a particular group of people. And sometimes it's really straightforward. What is feminist ideology? It's a belief in equal rights and opportunities for men and women. When we think about, what's American ideology? What do we think of? Maybe freedom, especially today. Democracy. I hope we think about responsibility, too, in terms of our own responsibility as citizens to maintain those two aspects. Sometimes it's really stated, but often the products of that culture have that embedded message, and they may agree or disagree with other elements of a culture's beliefs and practices. So in other words, it's a way of thinking about the politics embedded in a text. How many of you remember the Newlywed Game? Do you remember that on TV? Did you watch that? They had this series of couples, and they'd always ask them, and they always say something like, you know, where do you make whoopee? You know, or something like that. And they had all of these, you know, they'd ask the couples questions, and they could win a washer and dryer or something like that. I think it was so popular, it was brought back, and there was the new Newlywed Game. Well, one way to think of this is, well, that's just popular culture. What does it matter? But what someone who's studying popular culture or someone who's invested in American studies is going to say, well, wait a minute. What's the ideology embedded in that text? Is it conservative, patriarchal in nature? In other words, is it really reinforcing our ideas that the man wears the pants? That was another question they would often ask. Who wears the pants in your relationship, right? And part of the humor of the show was, right, seeing the couples look at each other like, I wear the pants in the relationship, you know, the man would say. And the woman would say, I, you know, what did she say? And so there was sort of the popular was when those couples would have that little tiff on air. And then the people who actually won were the people who probably had worked out their answers ahead of time. And so when they asked me the question, I'm going to say, you do, honey. And we'll both go home happy and with a new washer and dryer. Another way to think about it, though, is, well, how did you watch that show? It's not only what that show is presenting, what are the values that that show is reinforcing, but how did you consume that television show? Did you watch it and say how those couples relate or what I should do? Do you watch Dr. Phil and think, is the advice that he's giving, you know, are you using that as a sort of way of learning and valuing his message? Or are you saying, is it sort of a show you watch because you love to hate it? Right? you watch it because you can yell back at the television. And say, oh, I can't believe this guy's such an idiot, right? Is he really a doctor? Or look at those couples. They don't have a great relationship. As we've been moving along here, we've been thinking also, maybe without consciously thinking about it, another key term, which is mass culture. One way to think about mass culture is that it's the pool out of which popular culture is selected. Mass culture produces cultural commodities designed to appeal to as many people as possible. Again, here I'm drawing from John Fiske's article. It's an industrial network that produces many of popular culture's resources, produces the CDs, the television programs, the music, our films. But unlike popular culture, the use or lack of use of these products does not figure into the definition. So from mass culture, it's sort of like when you go into the grocery store and you need to buy toothpaste. How many choices do you have these days? I don't understand why there has to be so many, you know, whitening, tartar control, not tartar control. You want the classic old toothpaste? Do you want the stuff with sparkles? Do you want it to taste like cinnamon or cheeseburgers now? It seems like they've got every flavor. That's mass culture, right? And you could think of popular culture as, well, that's sort of when you have a successful brand. That's what gets picked up. Why don't you buy the generic? You know it's just as good, right? But there's something about buying Crest that just seems to make you feel better. So out of mass culture, then, out of that pool, out of all the music that's produced and put out there, we select, or out of all the movies, right, what becomes a blockbuster? All the movies are part of mass culture. What becomes a blockbuster becomes a part of popular culture. So popular culture, let's look at these three characteristics. Use first. Fiske talks about it as the art of making do with what's available. So unlike folk culture, where you might have an investment in tradition and maybe even have an ability to produce new products out of those traditions, popular culture has to do with whatever comes out through mass culture. American culture and its people shape and are shaped by mass culture and popular culture. So it is shaping us. In that sense, we're sort of passive recipients of that action. But what Americans use and how they use it distinguishes mass culture from popular culture. And this is really where the power lies. That we have the choice, or that we make those choices. We select it. Roughly, this is from John Fiske's article, roughly 80% of the products of mass culture are rejected by the people. They fail. You think about how hard it is to become a part of popular culture. Only 20% make it in there. All those brands of toothpaste, right? The cinnamon didn't get picked up, right? It wasn't popular enough to be produced again, or whatever flavor. I think bubblegum has made it among the kids. But all those different flavors. Why are mint and spearmint? So, because those are the classics, that's what's... The market is there for them. They keep, mass culture keeps producing it. If it doesn't, they're not going to keep producing it. But interestingly enough, while we may notice trends, we can't necessarily say there's a universal standard or selection for the criterion. If we could, boy, we could, we make a lot of money. Right? And that's a lot of people's jobs, is try and figure out what it is that's going to be popular. What's the new trend going to be? I was just reading, I think, in the paper, there's a whole group of people who decide what colors are popular. For all the different... So it's not only in terms of the fashion industry, but it's what colors get painted on the walls. to what colors are available if you're in the market for a new car. So they try and predict that, and they try and influence you. Right? But ultimately, you have the power to decide if you're going to paint or you're going to buy a brown car or not. I think brown is one of the newer colors for vehicles in the next few years. So in this sense, it's socially located criteria of relevance. What does that mean? That sounds a little bit like academic jargon. Socially located criteria of relevance. That means that depending upon where you are, can also maybe depend on what's popular. Folk culture kind of works that way too, in terms of that regionally, right, there are differences. What you call, do you call soda soda, do you call soda pop, right, language differences like that. But when something gets selected by a lot of people in different regions in different parts, right, then you know this is a trend that's likely to become a part of popular culture. It's going to become a part of that 20% that's selected and makes it into that category. And this third characteristic, I think, is one of the most interesting aspects of popular culture. On one hand, right, we have a prescriptive norm, a prescriptive ideology that's a part of that text. A lot of popular culture is fairly conservative in nature, even though we might say you're not listening to rap music if you think that, right? But really, in terms of its gender politics, women as objects, that's been around for a long time. In that sense, we might say it's very conservative. So that idea that that's been popular for a long time, that people have bought into that ideology for a long time, makes it difficult to change. So that's that prescriptive ideological norm. That's almost the idea that whatever I tell you, right, you're going to absorb and take in, that you'll sort of be obedient to the message. But there is power there, and that is that you may not consume passively, that you may consume with your own individual needs and desires in mind. That may mean that you might choose not to listen to a certain type of music or engage in a particular type of culture, or it could mean that you may listen to rap music, but you do so with a very critical ear. Or you may listen to any kind of music that way. Because popular culture is so excessive, that sometimes we'll notice that we as consumers, and this is again Fiske's term, poach meanings. Poach out of that culture in order to do something, to make do with what's available, and end up, even though we don't have the resources so much to make our own movies and distribute them, or to make our own music and get it distributed nationally, although the internet is really interesting in that regard, and with new technologies making it possible to make your own movies, some of those tools, those elite tools of especially the media aspects of popular culture are changing. But most of the time, if we want to do anything with popular culture, we have to poach it. So what does that mean exactly? Do you know about Trekkies? People are kind of, oftentimes they're characterized as really extreme fans of the Star Trek TV shows and movies. They dress up like the characters. Well, these people are really pretty creative. They might do community service dressed as their favorite character. They might attend a trial, if you remember the Clinton when he was on trial, I think it was with the land. Now I'm blanking on what the term was. Do you remember the land? Whitewater, right? Yes. And they had the woman who was the commander, and she dressed up in her Star Trek uniform every day. She was an alternate on the jury. Right? So they're taking this element of popular culture, and you might say, oh, well, these people, oh, they, you know, they're delusional, or they, you know, are just a little different, a little wacky. But it's another way of saying, I'm using this aspect of popular culture, and I'm creating something different out of it. I'm making it my own. That's probably a very extreme example. But every day, when we watch TV, or read the newspaper, or turn on the radio, or decide what New York Times bestseller we might want to read, we're doing some aspect of making do with what's available and poaching some aspect of that culture through that selection. We may not be as extreme as Star Trek fans, but we're a part of that process. So kind of as a summary here in terms of popular culture's key features, when we think about its use, as consumers, we really have to make do with what's available. The elite production of mass culture and distribution of it takes that out of our hands. We can produce folk culture. We might even, if we have the talent and can be accepted by the elite, could produce high culture. But as individuals, it's very, very unlikely, very, very difficult for us to produce mass or popular culture. That has to be done with much larger organizations and groups. But we do have the power of selection. This is not the power of the elite. And we also have the ability to consume it, you might say, straight, or to twist it. Think about the shows you may watch that you would call your guilty pleasure. Or the shows, as I said earlier, that you love to hate, that you watch in part because you critique them. Or just think about, you know, again, watching a television show with a friend and discussing it over dinner. That's all a part of our critical consumption, just as we would talk about or critically consume a piece of literature. And one of the most maybe important things to keep in mind as we start to think about interpreting all this, we've done all this defining what is it, that definition helps us understand how to begin to interpret it. But we have to keep in mind that we can't isolate an understanding of popular culture from its users, because those are the people who picked it to begin with. So when we interpret popular culture over the next few weeks, and I think that this is true too, especially for folk culture, that it requires a couple of things. One is that it requires us to distance ourselves. I find that especially when I teach classes on popular culture and popular music, the students love the fact that they get to look at, let's say, lyrics of the most popular song that's out. This is their stuff. But they often have a problem, right, because it's so much a part of their entertainment, of distancing themselves to uncover the text's ideological norms. They say, oh, can we just listen to it? I just like it, right? I don't want to think about it too much. Sometimes, right, then we realize, I'm not always comfortable with everything that I uncover when I start to look at this text. Or you may find, as sometimes I do, that if I had to sit through an episode of a TV program that I can't find any reason, right, anyone would want to watch, but it is so popular, so part of my, you know, I feel like a responsibility, I need to keep up, I need to watch it, I need to figure out, is this sort of exercise and to think, well, what is it that appeals to so many people about all these reality shows on TV, right? Why are there so many? Why are there all these shows about losing weight? Right? Are people walking across the country or some trainer yelling at you? What is it that people sitting on their couches, probably, or making their dinners, what is it that they get out of this? And so part of that interpretation is, especially if you enjoy that piece of culture, is to try and distance yourself from it. Okay. It's something I have to do too, even when I'm, maybe I'm teaching a piece of literature that would clearly be in high culture. We're reading Hawthorne's The House of Seven Gables in one of my classes. I love it. I think it's a great story. But, you know, my students don't always agree, right? And I had to distance myself from that experience. So I can say, well, what is it that would make someone not enjoy this text? What's going on with that? So this aspect of interpretation, I'm saying, is especially important for the interpretation of popular culture. But really, when we start to think about it, it's something important to keep in mind, no matter what text is in front of us, whether it's a part of low culture or high culture. But we also need to consider that insider's view. Because as we were thinking about, or maybe as you've been sitting here thinking about your own interactions with popular culture in particular, that sometimes how you use it, what you do with it, or like the Trek fans, right? That the relationship between that text and the user may be just as important to uncover than the ideology or the message that seems to come out of that text. What are people doing? How do they talk about their own relationship with this television show or with this piece of music? Why do they identify so much with science fiction? Why is it that they love mystery novels or romance novels? Why do you love the History Channel? What is it about the way that format, because if you looked at the narrative of many of the History Channel's programs, they kind of follow a standard story. But it's fun to watch, you know, all the different ones about World War I and then World War II. And, you know, even if that basic narrative structure is the same, what is it, what kind of pleasure do we get out of it? So talking to the user as well as looking at the text closely is key to the interpretation of popular culture. And I think it's key because it provides us, especially with popular culture, of a snapshot of that culture in progress. It's really hard to interpret the present moment, right? You know the old saying, hindsight's always 20/20, right? It's not, you know, the historian aspect of me, or if there was a historian in the audience, his history is not easy to interpret. No, I'm not saying it's easy to interpret. But to look at the present moment with that critical eye is sometimes very difficult. But if we can do it, we can get that little snapshot of what's important to America right now. Why was Britney Spears, if you turned on the television or turned on the radio yesterday, why do we care that her, and why do so many media outlets, from Entertainment Tonight to NBC Nightly News or CNN, mention Britney Spears and her failed opening for the MTV Awards? How did that make it across so many different news channels? Why did it make it across so many different news channels? What does that tell us about the current state of our American culture? But here's that question I said I would get to. But isn't all that really junk? Why study it with a critical eye? Why pay attention to it? Especially, I don't know, the extreme makeover shows or the MTV videos. And one thing to keep in mind is that there has been this long tradition of a movement from low culture to high. We might call it a movement from trash, low culture, to treasure. And Shakespeare and jazz are probably two of the most well-known phenomenons. Jazz culture was the rap music of its day. If you listened to it, you were loose. If you danced to it, questionable morals. But today, when we think of jazz music, or when I ask my students about jazz music, they consider that akin with classical music. What was once popular culture has become classic or high culture. Shakespeare the same. It was the popular plays of his time. And really, it became a part, if memory serves me correct, that it became most a part of high culture in the 19th century. Also, you may have noticed, especially recently around news, that there's an increasing blurred boundary between high and low culture in our contemporary culture. Our entertainment news, looks a lot like our regular news, and our regular news sounds and looks a lot more like our entertainment news. Fake news, like the Colbert Report, is sometimes where people go to get their real news. So the ways in which, if you remember back in a time where news, the nightly news, was very different from any of those other media outlets, you can say that definitely that's changed today. That today newscasters are very concerned, and they've always been probably, the networks have always been very concerned about ratings. But with the proliferation of so many 24-hour news channels, they're as concerned about entertainment and achieving audiences as they are about truthful portrayal and accurate portrayal of what's happening. So that blurred boundary is another reason why we need to have this critical eye on our popular cultures. And maybe last but not least, it's a reminder of the significance of everyday cultures. This is why we study folk culture. This is why we look at places like the home as a key location for history, when in the past, maybe we wouldn't so much look at our everyday practices. We'd look at the big world events, the wars, as a way of marking history. But why not mark history through the changing in washing machines as equally significant? That everyday culture and how women's roles in the home have changed, along with technology, may be just as important in understanding American history, American culture, as major world events like wars and other kinds of conflicts. So we're trying to also resist what I'm sort of calling the ostrich effect. I don't watch it, I don't have to think about it. It's not a part of my life. I don't want to deal with it. Here's a couple of things that I was thinking about when I was about resisting the ostrich effect. I have to recognize, as someone who teaches literature, what the National Endowment for Art Study has set up. 10% drop in reading from 1982 to 2002. And this is really important for the students that I'm teaching, because this is when they're born and now they're in their college age now. Which reaches across, this is a statistic that reaches across gender, age, race, and ethnicity lines. This means the way that you either had read one book this year or you hadn't read one book this year. That's what this statistic is showing. And of course, I'm like, read one book? Yeah, I read one book a week. Right? So often more. So fewer people are reading at least one book per year. The biggest decline is among people in 18 to 24 years old. There's a 28% drop. And non-readers, incidentally enough, are less likely to be volunteers. So I have to recognize this as a particular challenge in my teaching. I can't stick my head in the sand. That this is the reality of much of the population that I deal with for the traditional college-age student. So what are people doing? So American TV and media habits, this is from a U.S. Census Bureau study that just came out, I believe last year. This statistic, when I first looked at it, I thought, oh my gosh. Americans watch TV 25% of their waking hours. I don't know about that. It just seems like so much. So Americans will spend nearly 10 hours a day watching television, surfing the internet, reading books, newspapers, magazines, and listening to music this year. Okay, so we're getting a little bit more specific. So I believe that first statistic is a typo. I think it should be, well, the total for the year would be 1,555 hours of watching television total out of the 10. Someone do the math for me. I missed the first. It's not, I don't, maybe it's not 1.5 hours daily. Or it could be. We'll do the math later. I'll get back to you. 2.5 hours listening to the radio. You can listen to the radio and multitask, right? Might do that in your commute. When you think about people who are working or as you make breakfast in the morning. 1/2 hour listening to recorded music of some sort. And then 10 hours, doing a multiplicity of activities, including reading newspapers, looking at the internet, playing video games, or using other kinds of media. But obviously, reading books is a very minuscule part of that remaining 10 hours, or remaining time there. So media literacy, what those statistics tell me, is more important, if not as important, as the conventional literacy that English and literature programs have been charged with encouraging since we were established. That media literacy, when we look at how especially young people are spending their time, or you may even think how you spend your time, how you get your news, that kind of literacy is as important as the kind of literacy that I was just teaching last evening, how to read a poem, how to figure out a rhyme scheme, right? You remember those lessons in maybe grammar or high school or college? But how to read a website, how to understand how news in our contemporary culture is produced and made, that literacy, we might say, is as important, if not more important, than the reading of a Keats poem. So our everyday cultures that we engage with, this is a sort of argument that the whole series of lecture sets up, have significant educational force. They teach us in conscious and unconscious ways what it means to be American. And we also, through our selection, especially of popular culture, reinforce or perhaps shift directions of what that definition means as well. What does it mean to be American? To be a political agent requires an understanding of the pedagogical power of popular and folk cultures. The advantages that knowing high culture, I think, are fairly clear in terms of how the cultural cachet that can get you in your workforce or talking with friends or just simply in sharpening your mind. But the pedagogical power and influence and how that can help you become a stronger political agent of popular cultures in particular may not be as apparent initially. But maybe a little bit more so by the end of today. So what are we going to study in this class, keeping this in mind? We're going to understand how to engage and critically, or how to understand and critically engage in American culture. We're going to look at the folk roots of much of American culture. We're going to identify and understand the origin of some important stereotypes. We're going to analyze significant American myths and values. And we'll do this through an intensive study of a range of scholarly folk and popular texts. So we're ready to open up for discussion. We have 1/2 hour. And to kind of get this started, I have a couple of suggested questions, but please don't feel that you're limited to responding or to commenting on these topics. Well, one of the things I'm really curious to hear about is your relationship with popular folk and high cultures. Have these relationships changed over time? Why or how? Would you consider yourself closer or further away from popular or folk culture? From 30 years ago? From 5 years ago? Do the statistics that I showed you about declining reading habits maybe replaced or, in that sense, increased other kinds of media habits, more television watching, more time on the internet. Does that jive with your own experience? Is that how you spend your days? And do you think you can be a political agent these days, an informed citizen, so to speak, without being media savvy? We might want to have a little discussion of which do you think is more important, aesthetic quality or the political popular impact of a text? And then any other questions and comments that you have. So I believe there are microphones, and if you have a comment, raise your hand and we'll try and get a question over to you.
Please listen to part 2 of the First Lectures podcast to hear the audience and instructors.